dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. We're told, especially now, that we must have a vast apparatus of police, law, courts, jails, armies, and even covert informants in order to protect democracy. What is democracy? Democracy is understood to be a system of social organization that enables those affected by decisions to participate in making them. A society in which the government exists because the people consent to it. Central to democracy is the idea that everyone has an equal say in the process whereby decisions are made, generally some sort of open process of voting. We have voting. Ken Lay, the chairman of Enron, and you each have one vote. Do you and Ken Lay have an equal say about what happens in this society? Do the structures of our society really promote democracy, or are they promoting something else? People who've held minority positions, or are part of minority populations, have frequently had to give their lives in order to gain access to some measure of equality, and they have frequently had to break the existing laws in order to get the majority to consider their needs. Equality then was denied to them by the same system that claims to promote equality. Therefore, it doesn't seem that equality is what is being promoted or defended by the apparatus of state. But it gets worse. Most of the forces that govern our lives are not even subject to a nominally democratic process. Chief among these is the field of work. Most people spend about a third of their adult lives at work. Most have nothing to say about how they do the work, what work is done, or what types of employment are available in the society. Most people don't have the luxury of deciding whether the job they do ought to even exist, or conversely, have no control over their job's disappearance. Someone else is always deciding that. Sometimes it's not even clear who makes the decisions that the rest of us have to live by. Most people, therefore, do not experience living in a democracy. What they experience is living in a hierarchy, a quintessentially totalitarian structure. Hierarchical structures are easy to control. Control the top of the chain of command and the rest follows. Even where democratic structures exist, they are superimposed on a framework of hierarchy that tends to render them ineffective, repeatedly yielding a government that almost nobody is happy with. If you don't think that's true, consider this. Almost nobody drives the speed limit. Those who do, do so mostly because they're afraid of getting a ticket and the various financial consequences that result. Why isn't the speed limit set at the speed that most people would prefer to drive? What sort of social structures would do a better job of fostering a society that would be more pleasant for most of the people in it? Tonight on the program, a look at two methods aimed at putting more democracy in our lives: participatory economics and consensus decision making.
For my guns and my saddle will always be filled by...
We're schooled from childhood to accept the social hierarchy and to acquiesce to a position within it. We are graded, tested, and sorted according to the value placed on our capabilities by the existing hierarchy. This observation is central to a magnificent book written by Jeff Schmidt titled Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System that Shapes Their Lives. We hope to be bringing you an in-depth look into what Schmidt has written in the coming months. For now, Schmidt's book contains the following critique of hierarchical social formations. Schmidt writes, first, hierarchical organization takes the fun out of work. They centralize decision-making so that most people involved in an activity or project are deprived of creative control, alienating them from their own work and killing their enthusiasm. This makes individuals less productive. Ever notice how people work hardest on self-assigned projects and leaves them less fulfilled? Nobody says, "Wow, you work in a hierarchy? That must be fun." Second, hierarchical power structures twist people's personalities. The skills people develop for surviving in hierarchies are different from those they would develop in a democratic setup. As one secretary where I work confided proudly to another, "I know who's ass to kiss around here." Third, hierarchical power structures are necessarily secretive. Executives make key decisions behind closed doors. The hierarchical structure keeps people in the dark, even about issues that affect them directly, and engenders rumors. Fourth, hierarchical power structures create repressive environments. They produce fear and insecurity, killing free expression and spontaneous activity. People huddle and talk in hushed tones. CYA governs their work. Criticism of the status quo and trial and error are necessary for progress, and so hierarchical power structures slow progress. Fifth, hierarchical power structures stunt personal development. They cause conformist behavior by increasing the personal risk associated with creativity, independent thinking, and dissent. They narrow the scope of each individual's work, ensuring that most people do not experience a wide variety of activity. In these and other ways, hierarchy deprives individuals of the environment of freedom and experimentation necessary for personal growth. Sixth, hierarchical power structures are inherently violent. The few can't maintain their authority over the many through rhetoric alone. Although bosses, for example, rarely use guards or police, their right to do so influences people's behavior, most obviously during individual confrontations and strikes. More importantly, on a daily basis, hierarchies subordinate and humiliate, and, as mentioned, make people's working lives a grind, warp their personalities, perpetuate their ignorance, repress their spontaneity, and stunt their personal development, amounting to a kind of violence against the individual. Some individuals respond with actual violence. Those pushed over the edge tend to go crazy in a particular way, aiming their guns up the hierarchy more often than down. But more commonly, people respond with many nonviolent forms of resistance, or with redirected violence, such as alcohol and drug abuse, and domestic brutality. All six problems here, and certainly others, are endemic to hierarchy. They will eventually arise in every hierarchical system, be it an economic system such as capitalism, which is inherently hierarchical because authority originates in ownership, or a hierarchical workplace, political organization, social or volunteer organization, or personal relationship. Any such social grouping can be organized non-hierarchically and is always more human when it is. That was an excerpt from Disciplined Minds by Jeff Schmidt. The method of consensus decision-making is becoming increasingly popular as a means to democratize groups. What is it? How does it work? What are its strengths and weaknesses? What we're going to hear next is an excerpt from a discussion that was held last summer at the annual Renewing the Anarchist Tradition Conference in Plainfield, Vermont.
I just want to introduce myself. I'm Andrew Dinkelacher. I work for the United Electrical Workers Union. That's my job as an organizer and negotiator and so forth. I've done that for a number of years. So originally, the title of the presentation that was to be in the booklet was, it started out with the question, who is renewing the anarchist tradition? And then it led to, and why we need consensus decision making and so forth. So I found, when I came here, it was interesting that that part of the title was disappeared. But I think that's an important question. I leave that as kind of an opening question for, I think, everybody to think about in terms of our role in looking at anarchism and how it relates to us, inspires us, and who's in fact a part of this process of looking at that, as well as looking at what is the definition of renewing and how do we look at renewal. What I'm going to say is how what renewal means to me. It may mean something different for you all, but that's part of the presentation. Renewing for me is really calling forth the basic principle that inspires writers and practitioners and theorists of anarchism for years and years to say, what draws me to think about this thing? And the principle that I pull out of that, that I have connected to very strongly and have seen throughout many of the writings and stuff, is the principle of community and autonomy, of the combination of the two. It could be viewed or understood as unity and diversity. It could be understood as self-determination and social cohesion. But it's the idea of valuing each of those principles and seeing that they are in fact mutually reinforcing and in combination. And this is very different than the way mainstream political theory or most sociologists or organizational theorists or organizational practitioners view this question. These two values are seen as in conflict with each other in terms of being on a spectrum. On the one side, you have self-determination and individual rights. On the other side, you have social cohesion and a sense of community or society. And if the political theorist or whoever is working within this idea of these being in conflict, but yet they value both of these things, are going to see it as a seesaw. How can we balance these two values and make them work, make them compatible in such a way as we can then move forward as a society, a healthy society? Now, that's the traditional way that the framework that is used within political theory, that's used within organizational theory, and used in how people make decisions, how people interrelate. It's a conflict. What the anarchists have brought about, traditionally, a lineage of anarchists, you know, talk about, is that these aren't two opposites of each other in conflict. They're, in fact, two separate values or principles with their own set of opposites. So if you look at self-determination, the anarchists assert that the opposite of self-determination is not community or a group, but it's the principle of someone else making decisions for you. So you're not in control. So you have a whole spectrum there of one principle. The other idea, the other value, is the sense of community. And here, the opposite isn't self-determination. The opposite of community is isolationism, is a sense of being radically independent, devoid of any social relationship or interrelationship with anybody, thing, or nature, or whatever, what have you. So as a result, the anarchists propose, and have asserted this for many, many years, that what we need to look at is how these two qualities of self-determination or autonomy is viewed supporting and enhancing community, and how community supports and enhances self-determination. That's what I sense as the renewal, as what we need to call forth from the past and kind of reapply to our current situation. One of the things is that for the anarchists back in the two centuries ago now, since it's 1800s, really viewed a threat to these two principles, or the combination of these two principles, is the state, government. Today, it's less so the government, and it's more so multinational corporations or whatever kind of form or manifestation these institutions have evolved into, because clearly they haven't remained static from back in those days to today. They have evolved and changed into new forms, new creations. So the emphasis here is really to link how are these new forms, these new institutions, are in direct violation of these principles, and then assess tactics and strategies for that. So out of this primary idea of community and autonomy, the combination of the two, of mutually enhancing and supporting each other, comes a lot of secondary, or what I would call secondary, principles, and very important principles, such as a non-hierarchical society, building you know, intimate relationships that are based on non-coercion. The idea of mutual association or voluntary association. So all of these kind of manifestations or principles, consensus decision-making falls within that as well. That all of these are an outgrowth of this core idea of these two are not seen as opposites but are in combination. So here's how they can be applied and so forth. So as the institutions change, then the view, by holding on to this basic idea, you can then think about, well, how does the idea of losing the sense of a town green, a public space, to a mall where it's a quasi-public space, but if you actually go in there with t-shirts boycotting certain products in the mall, you find out that you can't wear those t-shirts. They arrest you or kick you out. That you can't gather and actually have discussions or things like that, that you can. As well as the application of how the attacks on the internet, currently it's in a more freeform kind of space, but that it's going to evolve into a more capitalistic kind of pay-as-you-go internet in exchange. A perfect example is the fact that if you generate listservs and you want to send messages from your listserv and you're off AOL and you want to send it to people on AOL, you can't. Your web server can send them, but AOL is censoring. It's just like as if the current post office down in Plainfield said, oh, we decided not to send you this mail. We're going to hold this mail. Now, of course, that would be considered an egregious violation. You're stealing my mail. But in its current form, in the current incarnation of the internet, nobody's thinking about that. And that's something that anarchists can really bring to these situations, is a sense of perspective on how is this violating, one, my ability to communicate with you and build a sense of community with you, as well as building or restricting me from being a complete human being, from being fully, you know, self-actualized, to be all I can be. So that's the excitement that anarchism actually brings, and is in fact not limited by tactics or strategies, just because capitalism or whatever the current dominant form does changes itself. It's constantly renewing, bringing it back to this basic principle and saying, how do we evaluate this situation according to that principle? So what I looked at then is, here's a basic principle: community and autonomy in collaboration with each other, supporting each other. It begs the question, are there social organizations that we can create that allows for this to be simultaneously optimized, to be reinforcing to the degree that it just keeps building on each other, that you keep growing as an individual, the community keeps growing, and you keep growing on top of each other? And so when you look at that, again, it goes back to the anarchist tradition that it is possible. That's what we've been saying. That's what anarchists have been saying all along. It is possible to build a society that is grounded in the collaboration of these two principles. And the way that I've looked at it, these organizational forms tend to be deeply or directly democratic, based on certain kind of decision-making processes and procedures that ensures the protection of those two principles. And that leads me to consensus-like processes that, as a container for protecting these two principles and ensuring that the group and the individual are constantly on guard against when are we being subverted to coercive activity, to being manipulated, to all sorts of scenarios where all of a sudden domination comes into play, sexism comes into play, classism comes into play. If the organization is continually reminded and has organizational processes that hold us to that, then that is what anarchism offers, is connecting how direct democracy as an organizational form, deeply democratic with specific consensus-like processes, meets these conditions, or is the best container so far to meet these conditions, and is the closest thing to an anarchical society that we have yet. It doesn't mean that there isn't more to go beyond that, but that's how it connects together there. So what I've done was to take a look at consensus decision making and to say, or consensus processes, and to say, well, what are we talking about in terms of viewing it in relationship or in evaluation to community and autonomy, community and self-determination? Does consensus do that? Is it, in what form does consensus do that? So what I look at there is proposing, well, it that leads individuals to ask questions about, well, how is the agenda set? For example, I set an agenda here. I set the times. I was in control of all of that. You know, it leads you to ask questions in terms of how decisions are being made. It leads you to ask questions in terms of how people are participating. Is there natural constraints? For example, in this kind of environment, I'm currently the person standing up. I'm currently considered an authority or could be deferred to as an authority. That doesn't mean you have to agree with me or anything like that, but that's traditionally how it's viewed. A discussion environment may be inclusive of some people who are readily easy or have a much better time at speaking out, speaking in public, than, say, individuals who are better at one-on-one, having a discussion one-on-one with somebody. So are we, in fact, encouraging people to inclusive of that? So it really causes you to examine your behavior. So it really defines consensus more than simply a voting procedure on a spectrum of different voting or decision-making options. It looks at consensus as a relationship, as an interrelationship. So consensus is an interrelationship. It views it as valuing community and self-determination, community and autonomy. So rather than as a voting mechanism. So that forces you to start looking internally at your own kind of things. Am I encouraging people within the group to participate? Or am I participating and creating a supportive environment for people to speak out or speak their mind? Or am I being an obstacle to that? Are there things that the group's doing to me? And have I brought that up? Or where can I bring that up? So it starts to really to reframe the question of how consensus works within a group environment. So, and this is intimately connected to the two principles that I've, you know, brought forth, you know, of community and autonomy and the combination of the two. That's my thoughts. That's what I've been thinking about and have connected together with.
So just one question I have is, what do you think about the criticism that a lot of people and anarchists in particular have of consensus being that people oftentimes feel coerced or pressured to come to consensus, and that people in effect lose their autonomy because there's lots of pressure to, you know, either stand aside or consent?
Well, I can respond to that, but I wondered if anybody had thoughts too or wanted to bring up stuff too. If not, I'll respond.
It's a question I've had also. It's been my experience.
Something I've read, I don't know that I've seen it in practice, actually, but the point is not to have everybody agree, and that you're supposed to be bringing out different, if you're doing it right, which maybe, you bring out the different opinions and see where people stand, and coming up with something that everybody can live with.
One way to look at this is to look at, does consensus work? I mean, are we talking about a pie in the sky kind of thing, or does it actually work? And I know for myself, my personal experience, I've been through group processes where there wasn't a sense of coercion. Maybe those individuals who brought that up as an argument have experienced that. It's not to deny that that doesn't exist, but that in fact, that the possibility and that in fact occurs is something very distinct from saying that we're talking about a process that has never worked, but we're going to try it anyway. Now, I can see making an argument that way. So the second part would be to look at it in terms of, well, if a person is feeling coerced, then I wouldn't say it is a consensus process, because
the group as a whole and the people that are facilitating it aren't being aware of the fact that coercion is coming about in terms of saying, aren't you siding with me? It's time. And that kind of devolves into kind of a voting status where I have a proposal and we're going to dismantle your proposal because we don't like it. So let's try and get as much support as we can on our side until we beat everybody into agreement. Now, there's a distinction, I think you were making it, which is there's a distinction between unanimity and unity. Unanimity means that you force everyone into a particular mold and they all look the same. The unity is the fact that you're bringing people together. They're going to walk into this situation different and they're going to walk out of the situation different. So you can come about a sense of, this is how we're going to move forward as a group. Yes, there might be people that disagree. Then we handle that as they come up. But I would return the question to say, is that argument brought up to argue against the principle that consensus decision-making is based upon, which is the combination of community and self-determination? Or is it against the fact that in this particular situation, consensus decision-making is not working as a procedural or a logistical question?
Where I work at a state library in Connecticut, and it's still a government office situation. It's still pretty much your standard, you know, compartmentalized structure. You still get orders from above to say, do this mm-hmm. this year. But they've been doing some experiments with having sort of groups, working groups that organize their little parts of the tasks mm-hmm. among themselves and figure out how it's going to get done. And one of the things that we've done in terms of training is we've had trained people who know how to teach people these techniques, or at least get them into the mindset of cooperating rather than competing against their coworkers. Right. So they started off with that, teaching like little lessons. My favorite is birds. You have everybody in the class try to write down how many birds can you think of in the next 1 minute, and you write them down. Okay, now you tally out all the numbers, and you know, some people are really good at it, some people aren't. And then they say, okay, groups of four, now add them together and see what more you can come up with. And then the numbers suddenly get big, because mm-hmm. you might know a lot of raptors and I might know a lot of songbirds. Put them together, you get a lot more birds. Uh-huh. Just sort of techniques of showing people that yes, you can actually get somewhere by putting your heads together and cooperating. Mm-hmm. So some sort of background teaching, especially when you've got a lot of new people coming to it the first time, might be helpful. And I don't know if that's something that you have experience with. But also, one of the other things we do with facilitators is when we started out, we made it really clear what the role of the facilitator was. And we had somebody from outside our department. In fact, at first we had somebody who wasn't even a librarian or in the library at all. Mm-hmm. It was from another part of campus. In the personnel department, come in and be the facilitator, keeping us on time and making sure that everybody got a chance to talk, mm-hmm. they had something to say, keeping comments limited, keeping us on target with what we were trying to do. Mm-hmm. So that way it's not personal, because right. it's not somebody you've been working with for 15 years and have all these little personal grudges with. So after a while of learning that, we would rotate the role. Mm-hmm. You know, it wouldn't necessarily be the coordinator or the person who's sort of like the chair of that committee. It would be somebody else. And then they would do it for a while. I mean, I imagine there's many combinations. You could rotate it every meeting. You could have them do it for 6 months, whatever. So maybe this would not only be good for networking between different organizations, mm-hmm. but you might want to get somebody who's not in your group to come and facilitate your group. If there's some affinity between the mm-hmm. two and they're you know, going to cooperate
that's
properly.
That's a very good idea. Thank you.
I guess to go back to my question, I guess to point out how it would be fundamentally coercive is that with consensus, everyone, or at least the majority of the people, go into the process hoping to seek consensus. They all generally have the same goal of consensus. And so you could say that there's always a force or pressure or coercion of some sort to reach consensus simply because most people are going into the process with that goal in mind. And it might be the pressure of conformity more than that of authority, but it's still
a pressure, which one could say is coercive.
Right. The way I look at what was helpful for me, not that it's a solution or anything, but a helpful way of evaluating, say, group situations and how they arise. Many times people are unaware of what principle they may favor versus the other, and they see it as a versus. Like, the whole individuality versus community is another classic way of doing it, and because as long as they continue to see it as a fight between the two, then their dynamics that they bring into an interpersonal relation or a group relation is gonna say, well, we're more about community, meaning that we want to get everybody to agree. So they're going to weight their perspective, their view is going to be weighted towards community, and not really understanding how, by weighting it that way, weighting it so heavily on this end, you may in fact be violating a person's individuality or autonomy. And the other extreme is that a person that's so entirely just views, hey, I gotta make sure I say what I'm gonna say, and everybody better listen, kind of thing. You know, this kind of self-assertion to the point, like maybe it's the first time they really are experimenting and doing this, but they're doing that to the degree that there's no recognition of, well, how does this relate to being a part of a group or anything like that. So what the anarchist perspective brings is the balance in saying of not balance, but saying that the two are mutually enhancing, not mutually exclusive. Meaning you can't have one without the other. Whereas traditionally it's viewed you can have one without the other. It's a matter of finding the happy medium. So the anarchists are when they're sitting in a group dynamic situation, they may in fact notice someone that is aggressively self-assertive, wants to make sure they're heard, or whatever. And one of the things that, as an anarchist, you approach it, you say, hey, that's probably where their development is going at this point. What we bring into it then is relating what that person is doing to how does that become part of the collective, if it can become part of the collective. It doesn't say that just because everybody comes together as a group that we must be this group from now until we die. It's groups come and go. So it really talks about that emphasis. And one of the pitfalls of group dynamics and things like that is that you might walk into it with the sense of consensus, or people say, yeah, we're going to operate according to this idea, but they lose sense of the fact that the consensus is built on these two principles supporting each other, rather than consensus, we got to all agree, that's what consensus means. No, it does not mean that. It means everybody finds their place in the group, and out of that comes whatever the next movement is. I mean, the Quakers are very familiar with that in terms of their meeting style and so forth. And they in fact view consensus as a degeneration of their sense of the meeting, as they call it. They call it the sense of the meeting. So it's very interesting when you start to look at these two qualities and you say, well, is the group overall supporting these two principles? Or are we mainly hearing from those that advocate for community? Or are we mainly hearing from those that advocate vetoing everything that comes up because they disagree? So it's not as though it narrows down and settles into a final result and that's the end-all be-all. It's then understood as a procedure, a process, an interpersonal process. I might change my mind tomorrow. I might change my mind next week. But it's a question of, where do we feel comfortable now? Do we feel comfortable enough that, hey, I don't need to be directly involved in every aspect of this particular decision, but if there's something that's brought up down the road, then I'm going to be involved, and the container of the organization allows for someone to come in and to do that. But again, it's going to all be evaluated on whether, one, it enhances kind of group cohesiveness and sense of direction, as well as enhancing everybody developing as individuals. That's the music, that's the dance, that's the sense of direction. You know, that's how I kind of looked at a lot of that.
I don't know if this is something that would really be considered consensus, but I remember couple of years ago, I read some little article about decision making in small groups, and the idea was to kind of avoid an all or nothing opposition where people might say, well, this is a terrible idea and I don't want to have anything to do with it. How do you discern that from somebody who's like, well, this should be changed, but then I'll go along with it? And the idea was, most people have five fingers on their hands, so it's kind of like a vote, like a weighted vote. If you really like the idea so much that you're willing to actually make it happen, you give it a 5. If you like the idea, you give it a 4. Mm-hmm. If you really don't care, you give it a 3. If you generally like it, but there's one or two things that you think need to be changed, you give it a 2. And if you want nothing to do with it and you don't think it's a good idea at all, you give it a 1. And the idea is it gives more nuance to the vote, and you can see more clearly where people are, and you can also sort of distinguish the people who really want to get involved and do it themselves, and the others who might not really want to do it but think that it's okay for the group overall to have their name attached to. And, you know, and distinguish them from the people who think that's a really bad idea, and give them a chance to explain, well, why are you so vehemently against it? Mm-hmm. And maybe, you know, change the sense of the group later on. So I don't know, would that be considered consensus, or is that more like voting? Or
I mean, it's like people do consensus all the time. To understand it as something that's distinct, or something that happens only in this corner of the room, you know, is a wrong view to have, I feel. Because if, say, the group of us decide, hey, we want to hang out tonight, well, we've just agreed on, hey, let's continue keeping the group going. Well, that's a consensus, in a sense. Now, the decision to go to the movies, say, we all might agree, we might all have our different preferences, but we might all land down on the fact that, hey, this movie, I'd enjoy sharing that experience with you, even though I alone might not have chosen to go to that movie. That's very different, arriving at going to something like that. Or the example might be is that us three might decide to go to this particular movie, and you two say, no, I'm not really interested in that, and there's only two movies to pick, and you're more interested in the other movie, so we agree, well, let's break apart, go to the movies, and reconvene again. Well, you've just made consensus yet again on something, even though you didn't necessarily keep the identity specifically the same the whole way through. Now, that's very different than going to, I'll refer to the weighted votes a little bit, but that's very different than, say, doing majority rule. Now, what if we had done majority rule? Well, we would have won the majority, and we could have forced you to go there, which might have ethically been against you because it was about, you know, whatever the movie was about, you just did not like at all. Well, that's what consensus does, is it doesn't allow for the legitimation through a special procedure to coerce people. See what I'm saying? Whereas majority rule is like a magic wand where it says, okay, everybody, we're going to do majority rule. Bam! Now it's okay to coerce this minority into doing this. And everybody considers it okay. Whereas consensus, if it's truly honored, based in the anarchist kind of tradition and the principles of self-determination and community, there will be people that will say, you can't do that. Sorry, you know, that's just wrong. You know, and maybe a decision isn't made on that. But what it forces is it forces people to fundamentally assess their behavior and the group's behavior to, are we violating people's sense of self-determination, and are we violating our sense of social cohesion? You know. So that's why I define or refer to consensus as a process of interrelationship. Whereas that interrelationship may lead to voting. You may all agree that we want to do a voting on this particular item. It's not that important. That's an easy way of doing it. Fine. You might, in fact, all agree to do majority vote on something like that because it's not that important. It's not that relevant to kind of have everybody intimately figure that out. It also comes down to, you know, well, you ask questions like, well, how does everybody view the questions that do come up that decisions need to be made on? Are they more kind of like, well, you know, not to use the term business, but are they more kind of business procedural kind of questions that need to be answered, kind of like administrative questions that need to be dealt with on a daily basis? Does everybody in the group really need to be involved? Well, you pose that as a question. The group can talk about that and you can evaluate, because letting that out is saying that's the framework that we're going to try and solve this particular question. Then a discussion comes out of that. We don't know what the answer is going to be. None of us do. But it's a matter of expressing those points of view and saying our goal really isn't so that we're just going to have meetings all the time. Our goal is to move forward as an organization. Right. So it takes it away from, you know, focusing on, God, you know, even if we have majority votes too, we'd still have a lot of decisions to make. So you start thinking about, well, we're interacting as a group. There's problems to be dealt with. There's issues to be solved as we go. And there's all sorts of books and manuals out. The interesting thing about the majority of the books and manuals out on consensus decision making or different forms of decision making is that they don't do it from the anarchist perspective of how are these closer to or more in violation of the anarchist notion of a good society, you know, of unity and diversity and things like that. So when you walk in and read those books, you can read it through that lens of, all right, if they use that, would this be honoring this more than that? Or, you know, you don't, you know, and that's how you can evaluate different things, and that's how suggestions come up, and that's how people have discussions of it. Sometimes it does come down to being a more of an intuitive thing. But what it does do is it forces people to really think about who they are and how they're involved in the group. You know, what am I bringing to the group? Am I bringing a lot of baggage? You know, if someone's going to call me on it, you know, if that's the case, doesn't mean that that's wrong, but it means that there's some work that needs to be done on the individual level in order to be more productive at the group level and to offer more so that the total amount of whatever is brought to the group is greater than the sum of its parts. That's what we're seeking to encourage. So if someone has a real difficult time expressing themselves in the group, well, of course, we're going to talk about how can we improve those skills so that people, newcomers, come into a group. How do we get them up to speed? So you think of things outside of when we're actually going to make a decision and think of what's going to help reinforce building, when we come together as a group, building these two conditions, these two qualities. I don't know what the content of the group is going to be, but it really encourages that. So you think beyond coming together as a group. There's many things. As soon as I leave this meeting, this so-called meeting here, you know, I could be talking with you. Hey, you brought up some really good ideas, you know, whatever, da-da-da-da. Or I really can sense a lot of concern from you. And that's a one-on-one. We're talking about, you know, is there more anger coming out of this particular thing that meets the eye? Or, you know, but it allows for the expression of these kind of feelings and emotions. It might not always be relevant, and I think some people feel like it has to be efficient. And that's a mindset of a capitalist society, because capitalism is all about efficiency combined with profits. We want to be efficient. And efficiency has nothing to do with interrelationships. To interrelate with somebody, it's messy as all hell if I was to look at it economically. You know? But that's not, the point isn't so we can become efficient. The point is so we can become more human. I mean, I want to go to work to be human, not so that I'm an automaton. You ask anybody, it doesn't matter if they're an anarchist or not, they can't disagree with the fact that they want to be self-determining, they want to be a full human being, and they can't disagree that they don't want to be interacting with other people like that and making decisions like that. There's no way that they can disagree unless you uncover them and they say, no, I prefer being a dictator. I prefer telling people what to do. Then you know where they stand. Then you know that no matter what you do with that particular individual, you're not going to get anywhere in terms of trying to build the sense of community, the sense of society that you're going to have. And you're going to meet people like that. I'm sorry. It's just reality. But it makes it more frank in terms of where people are coming from and where they stand. And that's scary because it calls for more intimacy. It calls for more expression of human emotions. And it calls for you being in touch with your feelings. I mean, a lot of people don't do that. And especially in our particular culture, We are conditioned to act alone, to be understood as that there are heroes, that there are authorities, and that they are in control. Either you're going to be a leader or you're going to be a follower. You choose. And that's it. It has nothing to do with collaboration, any of that stuff. So it isn't surprising when you try and introduce this that this is, in fact, one of the most radical things you can perhaps introduce into a group situation. Is let's actually be together, you know? You know, and that's what some of the 60s were all about. I mean, there were encounter groups and all that kind of stuff. But, I mean, it was an experimentation, an exploration of how are we going to interact. And in a functional way, it's how do we interact to make decisions that affect our organization. You know, it's very, very challenging.
The talk you just heard was recorded last summer at the Renewing the Anarchist Tradition in Plainfield, Vermont.
I was born in the town of Allagash, Maine. From five generations of logging folk I came. For 100 years or more, my family's worked on this land, chopping and hauling trees with the proud skill of our hands. In all my years of living, I've seen companies come and go. It's we who do the work for them, but it's they who run the show. From far away, the boss has come to plenty for the few. But this work is in our blood, and it's the only work there is to do. In this wild northern country, this land of spruce and pine, of quickly flowing rivers and hills as old as time, we have hunted, we have fished, we have taught our children well. Now the company comes from Canada to make our lives a living hell. Oh, the living has been hard in this little northern town. We've known and worked in pleasure every inch upon this ground. Now the corporate devils come again to drive my wages down. We work for pennies if we work at all, we cut the pulpwood to the ground. Now I've stood here in this clear cut, seen the work that I have done. I've hung my head in sorrow for the forest that has gone. Tell me, what's a man to do when they've got him by the balls? When he's drowning in his debt and his back is to the wall? In this wild northern country, this land of spruce and pine, of quickly flowing rivers and hills as old as time, we have hunted, we have fished, we have taught our children well. Now the company comes from Canada to make our lives a living hell. Oh, but the elders moved away from here when the school shut down. Now one bout of pneumonia could take out the whole damn town. Tell me who'll be left to tell these stories when we're dead and gone. When I sing these songs of sorrow, who'll be left to sing along? As I stand here by this roadside, watch the log trucks come and go, shipping raw trees north to Canada with overburdened loads. They take away our labor, they take away our land. Now they take away our culture and we've no place left to stand. In this wild northern country, this land of spruce and pine, of quickly flowing rivers and hills as old as time, we have hunted, we have fished, we have taught our children well. Now the company comes from Canada to make our lives a living hell.
That was Allagash by Ethan Miller from his In Times of War CD. Robin Hanel has taught political economy at American University for over 20 years. In January 2001, he gave a lecture on participatory economics during the National Conference on Organized Resistance. The audience packed into a classroom at American University in Washington, D.C. to hear him speak.
What I thought this workshop wanted to discuss was what I call living what it is that we believe in. And it's not something that is discussed very often, and there's a lot of reasons for that. One is we have a lot of discussion that we go through amongst ourselves and with people outside our movement about what's wrong in the terrible society that surrounds us. So we spend most of our time on that, but that wasn't going to be what we talked about today in this workshop. Then we spend much less time on something that I have spent 20 years thinking more about than anything else, which is, what would we really replace this awful capitalist economy with? I probably, much as you, was influenced as a student in the 60s, first by discovering how horrific our capitalist economy really was, and then discovering that people had written about alternatives long before I was born. We had a number of examples of visionary, libertarian, anarcho-syndicalist, commo-syndicalist, whatever, writings about basically putting, basically suggesting the following: you know, it just isn't that, it isn't that difficult to do far better than capitalism. It's doable, and we can do it, and we should never allow ourselves to be convinced that we cannot somehow organize our economic activities and our economic lives in a way that is more sensible, that is more efficient. In that day and age, 25 years ago, most of us didn't think about in ways that preserve rather than destroy the environment. And certainly more equitable and just and more democratic. That those are possible things that can be done. Now, I've spent a lot of time thinking about that and writing about that, but that also wasn't really to be the purpose of this workshop as I understood it. For those of us who are convinced that there is a desirable alternative to capitalism, and that it is something that we can loosely think of as the economics of equitable cooperation rather than the economics of competition and greed. How are we going to go about struggling for that? And I have long believed that a very important component of struggling for that is working out ways to live according to those values and ideals for a whole host of important reasons. One is, people who were disgusted by capitalism over 100 years ago came and preached that capitalism was not only awful, but there was a far better alternative. But then, to a great extent, what replaced capitalism, and in the popular consciousness, what became the alternative to capitalism, which was called, and we can discuss till we're blue in the face, whether it was mislabeled socialism, it never resembled socialism. I've written and read about that for 25 years too. But it was not a desirable alternative to capitalism. People remember that. People know that just because somebody comes along and points out to you what's wrong with capitalism, and just because they say there's a far better way to organize the economy, doesn't mean they really know what they're doing. And doesn't mean that it would turn out better. Maybe it would turn out better in some ways, but it might turn out far worse in other ways. Well, one reason to start to live the alternative that we believe in is to begin to demonstrate to people outside our movement who have every reason to be skeptical that in fact it's possible and that it's desirable. There are other reasons to work this out, and that is that we can sit down and discuss the alternatives, but we will not get it right. We will have things wrong. And we need to be practicing the things we think work to discover to what extent they don't. and that we have to make some changes and adjustments, and we have to understand some things that we didn't understand very clearly, although we thought we did, and we knew we were right, that we could do far better than capitalism. We're not going to discover we're wrong about that. But we're going to discover, in all probability, as we begin living a different way of organizing our economic lives, that we were deceiving ourselves in some ways or others about what was easy, what was a problem, what was not a problem. And the other major reason that I think it's of critical importance to think about this and to begin to do this is I do believe that one of the great difficulties in sustaining a movement is providing ways for people who enter the movement, such as yourself, and become committed and convinced to making the world a better place. We somehow have to start to build lives that don't last for 5 years, for 6 years, that don't work only for single people or people who are childless, who work for people of all ages, and that one can live one's entire life and be sustained in a life of activism. We need to build the kinds of communities that basically practice our values, develop the ways in which we need to go about these things, and we need those communities because those are the kinds of, we need those communities to sustain ourselves. Now, during the April demonstrations, I had sort of a surprise visit from a group that came from Winnipeg, Canada. And they had been 36 hours straight on a bus. And they had called, one person had called me and said, well, there's a few of us that are coming in for the demonstrations. And we live up here in Winnipeg. And we are part of a Mondragon collective where we have a few businesses and we have some living arrangements where we know about your book called Participatory Economics, and we thought those values made a lot of sense, and we've been busy trying to sort of make this work. And we just thought we'd drop in and talk to you if you're going to be there and you're going to be at the demonstrations anyway. To my great surprise, I was also about 5 minutes late getting there. It was like 2 o'clock in the afternoon on the Wednesday. And there was going to be a good demonstration down at the Mexican embassy that the Zapatista support people were organizing. And I had to do something with that. And when I came over to my office, some of my fellow faculty members saw me as I was walking in, and they said, who are those people? I said, what people? There's a whole hall full of people out there that said they're waiting to see you. And there were about 36 people who had gotten off this bus, and they also said, well, makes sense, we should go down, and we'll go down to the Mexican embassy. This is the Wednesday of that April week. But it would be nice to talk for a little bit. It was a nice day. We sat outside. And the question, I was incredibly impressed, because the question they posed immediately was, what went wrong for you people? How did you manage to fail to continue to live in a way that allowed you to do the things you believe in? Because we don't want that to happen to us. And we can see, we can begin to see the dangers of how those things do happen. Well, we talked about it for a couple of hours. I was impressed because I thought, you know, I'm glad they know enough to know that they don't need to talk about the economics of globalization with me. They already know enough about what's wrong about it. They already know that something better than capitalism is possible. They're thinking about the really critical problem for them. And it's a critical problem not just for them and for us. It's a critical problem for the future of the world, because if we can't figure out the answer to that, then it is very difficult to broaden and deepen the kind of movement that will have to be big enough, powerful enough, and long-lasting enough to actually change things. So I was impressed that they posed that question. We talked about it for a couple of hours. Nobody has magical answers. And basically, I think that that's the question that we should have a workshop about today.
WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner, Syracuse.